Mr. Whittaker, Reel 13. We're talking about your time with 107 Brigade in Tobruk. And in August, as we've already mentioned, you became an OP ACK. How exactly did that come about? It's something you'd been wanting, wasn't it?
Yes. I'd rather fancied this job. I liked, I'd always been a bit nosy, really, and I liked the way things were happening. There's been quite a lot of changes taking place. But all my, the chaps I'd joined with, I'd mentioned, they, one was a gun sergeant, Les Marshall, Baker, I think he was a gun sergeant, Fred Langford, a particular friend of mine, he was a bombardier signaller. In fact, they're all getting on except me, and I thought I'd begun to get a bit ambitious, I suppose, although I wasn't particularly bothered. But they, we'd also got split away from, we'd had a couple of moves. They'd put 1st RHA together and us, simply be swapping troops, and then we moved right up quite a lot away from them, nearer to the Aladdin Road, and I was moved to A Troop. We'd also lost at this time Jack Gore, my favourite signal sergeant. He'd gone, I've a sneaky feeling we'd lost our old drag ropes greensmith there, and I have forgotten, but there was something, I think his nerve had gone. And I certainly had one sergeant who went to, I'd mentioned, who used to sort ammunition in Mersham Troop, and he had some sort of breakdown. Saw him later, he was collecting solid shot on the tank range at Almarza. But anyway, me, I was moved to A Troop as signaller, did occasional, went up occasionally to the OP, just not to stay there, but just delivering supplies and just for the run up. Helped out on the gun position system, you know, relining the guns. And then one of my other young specialist friends who'd been in OPAC, I think he was taken ill. Anyway, he came down from the OP, and to my delight, I was told I was going up to A Troop OP, Captain Pringle. Farmer from either South Yorkshire, North Nottinghamshire, somewhere there. Bit of a dour sort of character. I found that in talking to him, I think he found it a bit difficult to just get on with, just to get on with people. It wasn't really at his ease. It wasn't ever so easy getting on with people. Unlike a man like Graham Slynn in B Troop, who could maintain his authority and, you know, call you by Christian name when necessary, or all the bloody fools under the sun, you'd take no offence. But to say, Willie, we call him, Pringle, I was posted up with him, a bit apprehensive. Anyway, I went up to this OP, 42, just to the left of the Aladdin Road. I always call it, when I'm thinking about it, an ideal OP, you know, nice and unobtrusive on top of a 15-foot pole, like a crow's nest, a steel pole with handholes each side. We climbed up, we'd sandbagged it to make a seat, I think. Or we may have had a car, or tried to remember a car, whether I had an old car seat, I had some sandbags around and a telephone.
How big was it up there? I mean,
well, you could sort of hold both hands out and hold it, you know, it was about two of you could get in at a pinch.
So about 2 yards square.
Yeah, well, it was round, just like a crow's nest, steel. The Italians had put it up. At the foot of it, there was a concrete dugout, bunker, as they'd call it now. A few hundred yards away, there was another concrete post, which was the infantry post, their headquarters. These were Italian fortifications. As I said, the road ran running south from Tobruk to Aladdin. We were not many yards behind the wire, just in front of the wire with the anti-tank ditch, and all round us minefields, which were only indicated. You could actually see the mines as sand blew away, but there was just a single strand of wire and a little post to hold them up. But you got used to the, for instance, you went out of the, you stayed at the infantry post at night, no guard. You know, didn't have to have anybody on duty. You had a telephone there, and this was a sort of triangular path. You went out along the path, then you had to do about a 45 degree turn back to this OP. About 100, maybe 200 yards to the rear and slightly to the to our left, we had a scaffolding pole tower, which the engineers had directed. The engineers told me when they came to mend it after one of our incidents, and they told me it was 70 feet high. I believe in there they said 50, 70 sounds much better. It's 20 feet high. From there you got a better view, you know, you could see into some of the dead ground that was in front, and onto just onto the escarpment. In front of us it was...
Would you use that one as well?
Yes, we used occasionally... With both the officer and myself would go up the big pole, as I call it, and he, if he was firing, he'd give me the fire orders, which we had the phone, and they'd go straight through. Or occasionally, we'd do some cross-referencing. One of us would be at one pole and one at the other, so that we, if we'd spot anything, as I say, you'd get a cross-reference.
Now, what about, what was it like up the poles? Well, the smaller one first, the 15-foot one.
Oh, it was, I found it very interesting. After a time, it was, you just went up the pole and sat there, and you'd, I can't remember that we had an effects routine, that probably, the officers, usual thing was 3 days, but I used to stay up there a week, sometimes a bit longer. And the officers would swap over, have Captain Pringle, usually a lieutenant, Lieutenant London. Another officers would come up for a couple of days, I think for experience.
So you really liked it?
I liked it.
Because you could have gone back after 3 days, presumably.
Yes, I could have done, but they said you want... At first, Captain Pringle said, well, you ought to stay up here to get... for experience, and gradually after some weeks I began, you know, he began to trust me, to know what I was doing. He had certain things as far as I remember. First thing in the morning you had to report, go to the pole, and then you report you were there and it all was quiet. About midday we sent down the situation report, sit rep, we call it, and then we sent another at night. Usual thing was if you could see movement on the escarpment, couldn't tell you a distance, a few thousand yards in front. There was a line of Italian positions, and the ground sloped from right to left. Behind that there was what we call dead ground, you know, in other words, ground you couldn't see into. Up to the Italian positions, the ground sloped slightly upward. Then it dropped, and then rose again steeply to this escarpment, which must have been several hundred feet high, on top of which was the El Adam aerodrome, airfield as they called it now. It was an aerodrome to us, and we could just see the tops of the hangar from the little pole, and we could see about half the hangar from the big pole. Eventually, we found out they'd built a road, they'd bypassed to go, built a proper bypass. And you could see traffic when you're at the big pole, and we used to go up there and report traffic. From the little pole, you could see movement, but you'd estimate it. You'd look through the binoculars, so it's occupied so much, maybe 50 vehicles, convoy moving east, convoy moving west, give the time. You'd jot the time down and then put it in the sit rep.
Would you open fire on things like that?
No, not normally. occasionally you'd have a gap, and we had a position which was usually not us, but we observed, but B troop had a position just behind the wire, and they'd bring a troop up, or even a couple of guns, or even three guns, and fire, just give them a bit of harassing. But ammunition, we were limited to ammunition. When I got up there, never had a chance to do what I wanted to, of course. The big thing was, stand to number one ranging and fire. But eventually they did let me have a go or two, but it was usually about five rounds in total, which went only on a fixed target and fire. The other thing spotted was troop carriers, JU-52s, which flew backwards and forwards, usually along the top of the ridge at low altitude, and you'd always count them, so many east or any area.
And that would be for intelligence purposes?
For intelligence. You just put what had happened. If you'd done any shooting, you'd put fired on target so-and-so, two rounds or whatever.
Did you do any registering, or was it all registered?
It was all registered. I did them a brand new panorama, which I can almost draw now. Had the road running, as I say, for to my right. Telegraph poles. One target, for instance, was a leaning telegraph pole, which leaned at a sharp angle. Had a burned-out truck to the west of the road. That was a target. The Italian positions, which we call sankers, there was stone and sandbags. You could just see the ridge. That was the target. Bir Azizi, which was a well hump, big hump, just like a big hump in the ground where there was an underground well. Deserted village, which was further out and could only be seen from the big pole. We had another target on the escarpment when we had the guns up forward, which you could just reach, and that was where they used to shoot at us from. As I say, that was what we could see, and life was sometimes we just sat there and nothing much happened.
When you did fire, do you remember the fire order routine now?
Can't remember it at all. I never had a what do they call it, an acronym of it, but of course we knew that in the heart anyway. But our favourite firing when we had a few rounds, and the first one where they let me have a go. In the morning you go out to the OP before at first light, which was a fairly a bit anxious because you've got a set of these minefields you were going through, fairly broad track, room for two vehicles, but you did have to, as I say, to pursue this roughly triangular course. So one of you'd get up the pole, or at first there was both of us when I was first there. And our favourite pastime, through your binoculars, you could see the Italians on this ridge come out, and they'd shake the blankets. And then Captain Pringle on one said, do you want to help them shake the blankets? Well, yes, please. So it would be target X1 or whatever it was, number one ranging, fire one shot to see that you were fairly near, and then probably some one round gunfire. And of course you'd see people running hither and thither. At the time it pleased me, now as I think of it, it was a rotten trick. People just getting up in 25-pounders, blasting somewhere around them. Never saw anybody fall down, but as I say, there was somebody there, and it gave me a bit of practice in. Sometimes the rounds, the guns varied, of course, and they sometimes fall short. We had a new target after I'd been up there some weeks. We went up one morning and we found a brand new pole, triangular pole between what was Bir Azizi and the Italian positions. And you could see what appeared to be somebody going up it. It was fairly indistinct because it was sort of just hauled down, you could see the top. And we didn't know whether it was a dummy or whatever. And we did, that was one thing, we did range whilst I was there. When we went out, we did actually have a look, and we, the nearest shot was about 50 yards away, which I declared was mine, but then all the others said not likely. That was, but that was as near as we got, and it was a dummy. And the man we'd seen going up saw it was a dummy figure with a rope round his neck, and they must have just hauled him up every now and then.
Did you, when you were up your the poles? I mean, 15 foot's not very high, but 70 foot's quite high. How did it? I mean, were you nervous going up the first few times?
No, not particularly.
The height didn't bother you.
The height didn't bother me. It had got a that screw piece was about a couple of feet wide into one side, handholds. But occasionally, it'd come down. If you're feeling jocular, it'd come down the other side through the scaffolding. It was heavily sandbagged at the top. We had the telephone wires up there, but we would take the telephone up with you and connect it up. We dropped one down one day, telephone, unfortunately.
How come? While
we were coming down, I think slung it over his shoulder. I'm not admitting responsibility. It worked when we put it together, but it wouldn't fit together. It was a metal case.
When you were up there, I mean, did you feel vulnerable? Because, I mean, if you could see them, they could presumably see
yes.
you.
Yes. The thing was, they did shoot at us. They seldom bothered the little pole. But the big pole, they would shoot at us. And as I said, the Italians were, they were just within range of our forward troop. But it meant you were firing and giving a position away. You could see the guns flash when you were on top of this big pole, and you'd say a couple of prayers, probably hear the whistle once or twice each shoot at you, that a shell would come over the top and raise all the dust on top, which was exciting. But then, if with what they meant it, sometimes they'd only fire a few rounds, as we would at the blanket shakers, but sometimes they meant it. And if you found they did, what you did, you watched the guns flash, and as soon as the shells burst, you're over the side, the first one, either the officer, or if there was only one of you, you had to do it. If there were two of you, first one of you down, and you could just get to the bottom, and they've got slit trenches, and into the trench before the next lot fell. You could just, but you had to, you didn't have to miss your step. And then, as I say, if there were two of you, the second one would go after the next round. But as I say, it was a question of sort of flash, bang, down, and no messing. The most exciting thing I had with that was when Ted London was up there. We were doing something or other, and he was up the big pole, and I was up the little one. And I started, they shelled the big pole, and I was horrified. They hit it. There was this enormous bang and a flash, and it sounded different. And we were connected the phone. We were connected the phone to the two poles. And I can remember sort of saying, you know, are you all right, sir? And he said a few horrible things. And I said, what's happened? And he said, you've knocked a piece out of the bloody pole. And he said, I'm coming down, and so I checked with him. We said they fired, and got the bag, and he was down. When we went and looked, they'd taken the piece out from 10, 12 feet, straight out of one corner. And the Royal Engineers came up and simply put another piece on the outside, you know, as they do with scaffolding.
Wouldn't you have been safer up the pole in a bombardment than down? I mean, really, because
I think so, but it was a, you know, it was a, I think they thought it was such a, and as I say, a direct hit only took a piece away.
That's what I meant, you know.
It wobbled a bit, so he told me. I was glad it was him and not me.
I just think you'd have been, when you were under fire, it'd be safer there than in your bunker at the bottom.
Yes, you run away, it was a bit away from the pole, and you run and dived in. But it used to be quite, as I said, the first time I was up and all this dust, you know, you had whoosh and dust flew up round, you'd realise they were fairly But usually there were...
Did you ever get an aircraft attack on it?
No. In fact, the only aircraft I was before I was actually at the OP, and I went up one day doing something on the signals, and the Stukas bombed the junction where the Al Adam Road crossed, or where the wires crossed the Al Adam Road. And for some reason, they came up past that spot, about a dozen Stukas, which was extremely noisy and frightening because we were nowhere to, we were flat on the deck, a few hundred yards away. But we, as I say, the aircraft we saw, that was the other thing they had to report occasionally. You see the Stukas come straight over your head going down to the harbour. And of course, if you saw them come up from Al Adam, you'd radio that back or phone it back straight away.
And it was just you and Pringle or whoever?
And the driver.
What would the driver do?
It was a driver signaller.
So you were a signaller as well?
I was
so
a signaller as well.
And what would the driver signaller do during all this?
Hang about, cook, brew tea, and,
Would he take his turn? Or?
He wouldn't take his turn up the pole.
Would he repair the wires?
He'd repair it if there were any wires broken. But we didn't like them to go because he usually was the driver. Usually was a driver signal. Saved him up. Otherwise, there'd have been four of us up there. And as I say, you've got to carry rations and water.
You took your own rations with you?
Took your rations with you. And, made bully stew or something at midday and gallons of tea. They regarded the driver's signals as some regard as rather a cushy number. Because, as I said, the vehicles, we had an 800 weight PU wireless truck, and then eventually we had a Bren carrier, which led to my most exciting morning.
Was that while you were on OP duty?
That was when I was on OP duty, and I'd stayed. Captain Pringle had gone down, and he in the evening, and he rang me up, phoned me up later at the command post, and announced that I'd been promoted Lance Bombardier, which pleased me immensely. And then he told me he was sending up one of our young officers, Lieutenant Williams. In his own words, he said, "Look after him, it's the first time he'd been up." And he duly came up next morning, and I told him what I was going out, and it was quite a dark morning. I think the driver named Fry, I think it was Jim Fry, went out in this Bren carrier, and I could tell by then, with the distance, and we knew we'd overshot our 45-degree turn. So as usual, I just hopped off. I used to ride on the back if there was an officer rode in the front. And I hopped off the back, and you never turned round, because I said, although there was room for two vehicles, you never quite, you could tell where you were. It was just that bit lighter. It had been churned up, and it was all soft sand. And you've got these minefields each side, and you're going to find a thing around at 45 degrees. Usual thing, I'd walk back, find where the turn off was, and then shout, "Right," and he'd back up. And this particular morning, I walked back, found the thing, all, you'd be up to the ankles in this soft sand, and shouted as usual it did. And I heard this. I heard the Bren carrier start to rev up, and I knew he was turning. I could tell by the sound, but it wasn't. And started running. I said, "For Christ's sake, what the hell are you doing?" And bang! The bits of the Bren carrier flying past my ears, literally, big lumps. And, of course, there was me thinking, "God, there goes. Haven't even put my stripe on my sleeve, and that's gone." And they turned round, and it turned wrong way. If it had turned left instead of right, it turned in wrong to a mine. Blew the track, hurt the driver's foot. Jeff Williams broke his ankles or something. Of course, I don't move. I knew enough about it first aid, stay where you are, and went rushed back to the command post, phoned him up. And then went back. And Jim definitely said to me, he said, the bugger told me to turn round. young officer, and I was in a real dilemma. But anyway, Captain Pringle came up, asked me what had happened. He said, now, took me on one side, he said, now, just what happened? So I told him, this was within, as fast as he could get up there. Told him, and he said, you're all right? And I said, yes, fine. I was a bit shaken with it. And we carried on. I never heard another word about it, which I was very relieved about. But it was an alarming experience. But nobody ever, apart from what this driver said to me, I should like to say, when I meet Jeff Williams, we talk about Nottingham Forest, and he never came back whilst I was with the South Knots, and we've never discussed it from that day to this. But it was a most unnerving experience, especially me just having been got what I want, well, not wanted, but at least I've been got my first strike. It was the most alarming.
Was there any other incidents you recall before the breakout,
I dropped my third clanger there. I was told the three that I was ashamed of. We used to do stunts, as they were. We used to call them stunts.
What were they?
They'd usually it involved firing at night. And then you'd man the big pole, and all the guns in Tobruk would fire a few rounds on selected targets, and then you'd spot for flashes. Or they'd get bush artillery, the unofficial, to fire a few rounds and then spot for flashes.
Counterfire.
Counterfire.
And you'd be looking to locate positions.
And occasionally they'd have this other thing where they'd just say, man the pole between 2 and 4 and report any. And what they were doing, they were sometimes sending out patrols to try and provoke some reaction. And you're up there to see if there was any sort of small arms fire, anything you could see. And I was up there one night and I got a message.